Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Good morning, Brendan Graham.
Good morning, Miriam.
Delighted to see you here. He, of course, who wrote You Raise Me Up. We'll talk about that in a moment. First time I had a Mayo in about 4 months.
4 months, yes. Yeah. In this age group, we were kept within a very small circle of the house. So I'd say probably never went further than about 15 miles in the last 4 months. So it's great to be up in the city again, you know.
How did you find lockdown? Some people found it almost a relief and others found it very difficult.
Well, the hardest part, of course, was not seeing the children and the grandchildren. And that has changed in the last week or two. So I actually had a haircut from my 14-year-old granddaughter.
It's looking good.
Was charged commercial rates.
Excellent.
So that was the hardest part. Apart from that, normally, well, for writing, you're in solitude anyway. And sometimes that's the last thing you want, because the last thing you want to do is write to face the page and make the thing work. So in one sense, it wasn't that much of a change for me. And I actually got a lot of stuff written, and it also allowed me time to do something I've been thinking about for years, to go back through all the scribbles and scratches over the years and see, was there anything there worthwhile saving? Mm. And we might later be talking about one of those songs that came out of that. So that was all really good. I missed the interaction in being in studio and meeting, you know, fellow musicians and friends and all of that. And the other thing I found, it gave me more time for reflection and thinking about things like how insignificant we are in the world. The world will go on without us. You know, it will survive without people. We kind of think we're masters of the universe, but we're not really. So a lot of thoughts like that, which I think, you know, come through in more recent writings. So, yeah, I know it's strange to say. I didn't find it too strange, apart from the lack of connection with family and friends.
Are you a spiritual person? When you say you reflect, I mean, I suppose we're all just dots, but in this universe. But did it make you reflect even spiritually on the meaning of life when you were?
Well, of course it is, because you're kind of closer to the meaning of death, I think, in these times, and particularly at an age. Like a good friend of mine whom I've known for many, many, many years and would be of an age with me, he sent me a little note there a couple of weeks ago. He said, we may not see each other again, you know, because of the way the world is. So these things are brought right to the fore with you. And I think the other thing I probably learned was to be a little bit more patient and more compassionate and try to be understanding of other people and not as maybe self-absorbed with my own work and how important it is, all that stuff, which it isn't really. So, yes.
And of course, your lyrics, You Raise Me Up, it has to be one of the most famous songs in the world. Just tell us even this week about Quincy Jones, what he has done with your song.
Yeah, this came out of the blue. I think the world probably knows who Quincy Jones is and all his Grammys and producing Thriller for Michael Jackson, etc., etc. So I got a call from Hal Leonard, the big music sheet music publishers in America, to say that Quincy Jones had thought about a project to unite the world through music, because, you know, everybody was at home, children were at home. So they came up with this concept of getting one song that would be taught online free to people who had never played the piano, to children, to then more advanced ones, to really advanced. And the idea was to unify everybody and give them hope, and also to express a sort of gratitude to all the work that was being done. So they got in touch with me and they asked me would I write a foreword to it about the song and what it meant and its message of hope and inspiration. And then the session started, I think, in May, and they went on into June. So 7,000 people ended up playing various stages of You Raise Me Up across the world. And something over 900 then uploaded the song in like tens of thousands of parts. And then they were all collated into one giant global performance with piano players from very young to very old. Some were experienced. One guy had been David Bowie's piano player. And they put this together and they launched it about a week ago, and there were 52 countries involved. And I can see from the messages what it meant to people, that they felt they were part of something outside themselves, of something bigger, and the whole sense of community. So, yeah, so that went live. And again, a couple of the granddaughters played. So they're somewhere up there amongst, like, if you look at this thing, it's a picture of the globe, and the pictures of the players are minute, and they're all doing different pieces. So it's gone up on Facebook. People can see it on Facebook if they want to look for You Raise Me Up Global Piano Recital. So it was wonderful that out of all the songs they could have picked, they picked this one. So
you've also done something, and it's for charity, for Médecins Sans Frontières, and we're going to listen to that first. Tell me about this. You've done a spoken word version for Médecins Sans Frontières of your song, You Raise Me Up.
Yes, well, I was thinking, like most people, you know, what can I do? Now, I know there have been loads of versions of You Raise Me Up done. The West End Stars did a version for NHS workers. Denise Pearson from Five Star did a wonderful version. So there's dozens and dozens of versions just acknowledging the work. Then there's others which are raising funds. But I don't sing. I'm not an actor. I'm not an athlete and so on. And I was thinking, what the hell can I do that would be of practical help? And it happened randomly. I'm working with Cathy Jordan and Fergal Murray on a solo album Cathy's doing of my songs. And we were discussing songs and would we do You Raise Me Up or not? And I felt, well, we shouldn't really do it. It's been done to death unless we do something different. So we recorded Cathy walking in the church in Balbriggan and singing intermittent lines. And then somebody said, well, why don't you speak some of the lines, and we'll put the two of them together. So I did speak the whole thing, and that was it. And then Fergal Murray, off his own bat, came back to me and had put a piano accompaniment behind it. And we're all thinking, oh, right. So I thought it might be of interest to have the first ever spoken version of the song done by the lyricist. And I've a long association with Médecins Sans Frontières, so I contacted them. They're doing frontline COVID work in some of the poorest and most war-ravaged countries in the world. So I contacted them and said, look, I have this idea. Would it be of any help to you? They're also doing work in Ireland. So you have young Irish doctors and going out to these countries. And I just thought that might be something useful. So with their blessing, we've done this. Eric Campbell did a fantastic video, which was loaded last night. Just got there in time.
Well done for your premiere.
For my premiere. So people can look at that. It's called You Raise Me Up Spoken Version. And there's a direct link to the Médecins Sans Frontières website where you can donate. And even if you want me to stop speaking, because I'm not a singer, donate to get me to stop.
We're going to listen to tonight. Stay with me, Brandon. Okay. Let's listen now.
When I am down, and oh, my soul so weary, when troubles come and my heart burdened be, then I am still and wait here in the silence until you come and sit a while with me. You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong when I am on your shoulders. You raise me up to more than I can be. There is no life, no life without its hunger. Each restless heart beats so imperfectly. But when you come, and I am filled with wonder, sometimes I think I glimpse eternity. You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong when I am on your shoulders. You raise me up to more than I can be. You raise me up to more than I can be.
Really lovely, Brendan, your version there of your own lyrics.
Thank you.
Yeah, actually, for my lessons, you were sitting and going, it's really weird to hear your own voice saying it.
It is, absolutely, yeah. So if there's a rush now from Sony and Universal to sign me up, I'm available.
There is another lovely song. You were saying during lockdown it gave you time to look at songs that, you know, you mightn't have maybe focused on before. Tell us about this Eleanor Shanley song.
Yes, well, I've songs all over the place, pages, and sometimes pages fall out of a book or something, and I pick it up and I say, oh, it's a load of rubbish, or else there's something in that. So John Feely and Eleanor Shanley are making a duet album, which I think is fascinating in itself, because John is an incredible classical guitar player, and Eleanor has such a tradition in the folk world and outside of it. And I know John from when we were youngsters in Ballinasloe, and we used to play music in the local pub, and the owner would give us a bottle of orange at the end of the night, say, thanks, lads. So I was talking to him about something else altogether and just said, what are you doing? So I said, he'd just finished an album with Eleanor Shanley. So I had just come across this song, and I said, I have something here. I said, I know you finished the album. Could I just send it to you anyway? So I sent it to him and Eleanor. They both came back saying, we love it. We're now going to record it for the album and make it the single. So I was over the moon. But this song has a very special place in my heart, because years and years ago, a man called Tim McCarrick from Pennsylvania contacted me out of the blue through various resources, and he had heard Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears, the song about Annie Moore and going to Ellis Island, being sung in a pub in Pennsylvania by Colm O'Donnell, and the song made an effect on him. So he got in touch with me and he said, that song should be in every school in America. And he worked for the big music publishing distributors, Alfred Music, and that kind of happened. It got out into sheet music in America in a number of forms, with the Irish tenors and with all sorts of people. So Tim used only arrange work. He was a very good musician. And I said to him, why don't you write yourself? Why don't you compose? And he said, oh, no, I wouldn't get it out there. So I kept at him and at him and at him. And he composed initially a violin piece, and it got published. So he was thrilled. And then he got very ill then, and ultimately passed away in 2012.
Very young as well, cancer.
He was very young, yeah. And a lovely man. I'd met him a number of times in America, and his family, and they'd been here. And he sent me this melody called Canción de Amor, and I loved it. So I put a lyric to it and sent it back to him, and he was thrilled with it, but the song was there. And in the meantime, he had arranged a massive piece of Mozart for publication. And he dedicated it, the piece, to me. And he wrote on it that when the devil was being thrown out of heaven, he said to God, "Give me one gift before you dismiss me." And God said, "Okay, I'll give you one. What gift do you want?" And the devil said, "I want the gift of discouragement. Mm-hmm. With that, I will gain many souls." So Tim wrote all this out. I'd never heard the story. He wrote it, and he, at the end of it, he just wrote the words, "Thank you for the gift of encouragement." So,
That's a really beautiful.
So
story.
I rang his wife, his widow, Mary Beth, there a few weeks ago, and I heard about this, and I said, "Tim's song is going to be recorded at last." And John and Eleanor have very generously agreed to dedicate it to his memory. So it's a very special song.
We're going to listen to it now. And just to say, lots of people loving you, Brendan. Our listeners go, "Miriam, Brendan has the most gorgeous voice. I could listen to him talking forever." Another says, "Enjoying the show greatly. Lovely project and guests. But Miriam, who is the you in You Raise Me Up?" That's from Aidan in London.
That's another whole day's programme, Aidan. Yeah, that's I'm asked that. Sure, do I know the hell who the you is? Sometimes you write stuff and, you know, it can have an, I know it has an ambiguous meaning. So, Aidan, whoever you want it to be, it can be.
Which is great. Is that what you really feel, Brendan?
Yeah, yeah, it's a signpost. It can be mother, father, husband, wife, child, an inspirational moment.
Another listener says, "That spoken version of You Raise Me Up reminds me a little of Leonard Cohen." Another, Emma Ward, says, "This is not the first time Brendan has made me cry. He did a concert for us at the Waterford Civic Trust, which left a lasting effect for 200 guests in our City Georgian Room. He's the most courteous, interesting and soft-spoken man who has written the most moving compositions." Kathy Somerville says, "Miriam, wonderful to hear Brendan, his beautiful voice and songs. We often think and chat about him. He met my daughter Maria Somerville many years ago, gave her studio time and advice, had her on his live radio show. She has since released an album. We thank you from across the lake." That goes back to the words of encouragement. And another goes, "Oh, I love Brendan, Miriam." That this is from Ina in Mullingar. "You Raise Me Up. What a beautiful hymn."
Oh, thank you all very much.
Yeah, no, it's true. So listen, thank you for coming in today, Brendan.
Pleasure.
And we're going to go out listening to that beautiful song, El Nishani and John Feely, in memory of Tim McCarrick. He wrote the music. It's called Canción de Amor.
Yes.
Hold me. sing for me. You sing the words that I adore. And oh, how you sing for me. Your canción de amor. And oh, then you sing for me. You sing.
Well, COVID-19, as we all know, has had a major impact on all aspects of our lives, and the impact on people's mental health cannot be underestimated. As yet, we don't know the full extent of toll that months of uncertainty, grief and unemployment have taken, but there are warnings that there will be wide-ranging, substantial and long-lasting psychological and mental health effects. Well, joining me now is a mental health campaigner, someone who knows what it's like to hit rock bottom and to live with periods of depression ever since. Alistair Campbell, former Director of Communications for Tony Blair, now writer, communicator, consultant and ambassador for Time to Change Mental Health. Morning, Alistair.
Miriam, how are you?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm okay today.
Good. Yeah. I mean, before we talk hugely about COVID-19, I noticed a few weeks ago on your Twitter feed, Alistair, it was very interesting. You were just saying how you were feeling this depression coming on you again on that day. Tell my listeners about that.
Yeah, it's really weird being on Twitter as much because, I don't know, I'm sure you find this as well, that if you kind of go quiet for a bit, you get all sorts of people saying, why haven't you said anything about this? And why are you not sacking Johnson? And why have you gone quiet about Brexit? And, you know, whatever it might be. And so in the end, I just thought, oh, I'll just tell them why. And so I did a short video. It got massive, massive viewing. And basically saying that I really was feeling very, very depressed. And I think it's really interesting I've always found, as you know, we've talked about this before, I find that when I am depressed, I find being open is much better than kind of keeping it all into myself. And you get a lot of nice people saying nice, you get all the usual sort of, you know, I won't say the word, but you get lots of nice people with support and ideas, and some of them are bonkers and some of them are good and some of them you use and some of them you don't. But, you know, I was really just feeling, I think it was, I don't know what happened really, but, you know, because I've actually had a pretty good run of it. I had a little mini blip a few weeks into lockdown. And I think that I was already on a dive, and I've done this. I saw you tweeted my Living Better stuff, and I've written this book, Living Better, and I've put some interviews up on the website for a series that I did on Living Better in Lockdown, which are all, some of them on my website. And it was actually an interview with David Lammy, the Labour MP, that just tipped me into an absolute plunge. And I'll tell you what it was. It was him saying that he'd enjoyed it in part, being with the kids, being with his wife much more, you know, but he'd not enjoyed it, not having a routine, not going to Parliament. And he said the thing that really got him down, and he, like me, does have sort of, you know, depression from time to time. He said it was the realisation that for all the rant and rage at Johnson over uselessness on COVID or Brexit, whatever it might be, he said, we're absolutely powerless. And it was that. It was like, it almost hit me like a thump in the face. It was like, oh my God, I've been writing and raging and tweeting and blogging and, you know, I've been going on and on and on about how bad this government is. And he's absolutely right. There's nothing we can do. And, you know, so sometimes I feel that was the tipping point. The depression was already starting. I think that's just a regular rhythmic thing with me. But it always takes something like that that just takes me from a low point to a kind of absolute plunge. And it lasted about a month. I'm not blaming it on David Lammy, by the way. Lots of other stuff goes on. But that's what happened.
But you pull yourself out. Do you get yourself out of it or does it just pass?
It's a complicated thing. I mean, this is what I've written the book about. It's all about how do I cope with depression. And it's a combination of things. Mm. I mean, it used to be I was never open about it. As I say, I'd just kind of tough it out. I'd go to work. I wouldn't speak at home, but, you know, Fiona would just think I was in a bad mood or I was being horrible or whatever it might be. But actually, it was I just didn't want to share it with anybody. So the first thing I do now, I'm very, very open. I tell Fiona, I tell my kids, I tell a few close friends, and, you know, they all deal with it in different ways. Fiona tends to... she tends to shut down a bit on me, and that's not, it sounds harsh, but it's not, because it's her way of dealing with it. She knows that in those circumstances, anything she suggests or tries, there's a tendency for it to get on my nerves and say, just leave me alone. So she tends to leave me alone, and she's there if I need her, and she's not if I don't. My daughter, Grace, is very in my face. She's very, you know, what can we do? Want to help? What can I do? Have a hug, whatever. My boys are a bit more kind of practical, you know, do you fancy doing this? Do you fancy doing that? And, but, you know, then for me, I've got a kind of checklist of stuff that I do. It was interesting there just listening to an advert in your ad break. You had an advert that was all about keeping fit, sleeping well, eating well. I do all that. You know, avoiding stuff that I know is bad for me, whether that's bad food or alcohol or, you know, whatever. So I've got my routine. And then the rest of it is just I try to find the good things in the bad things. So, you know, I'll give you an example. It's crazy. It may sound crazy, this, but one of the things I've been doing in lockdown is brushing up my German. So I've actually been during that period, I was listening to a lot of German, whether it was music or audio books or podcasts and what have you. And it's not that it necessarily helps, but it helps get me through it. It helps pass the time. And that insight that you've been through it before. This is the hardest bit. When you're very, very depressed, you think this is your life forever. You think it's never going to get better. And you have to hang on to these insights where you say to yourself, I felt this before. I've been worse than this before. I can do this. And then eventually it sort of lifts. And again, if people, I don't know if you can get Tortoise in Ireland. Tortoise is this new kind of long form journalism site. And I wrote a very long piece about that. And David Lammy, having triggered it, Nicola Sturgeon, in a funny sort of way, unwittingly helped me get out of it, because I did an interview with her. I hadn't, on the day, I really felt rough. I wasn't frankly wanting to do it, but I thought, well, I'm not going to turn down the chance to talk to Nicola Sturgeon about mental health, which is what we talked about. Mm. And actually, I know in myself, and I knew from the reaction, it was a really good interview. And that just gave me a bit of a lift. And I don't know, then I started to do things like, you know, as you know, I play the bagpipes and playing more music and listening to more music and starting to write again. Because what happened when I was manic, and before the crash I was manic, I've got no doubt about that. I was getting out at 4 a.m, I was writing thousands of words. I actually, one day I wrote 26 different articles for 26 different countries about how useless Boris Johnson is. Now, as it happens, they were all perfectly sensible and absolutely right. He is utterly useless. But that was manic. And I knew a crash was coming. And when the crash came, it was a bad one.
Do you know what's interesting, though? I was listening to that Tortoise podcast, and you spoke to a lot of sports people as well about how they've coped with lockdown. Now, obviously, someone like Gary Lineker, he doesn't have depression, but he was fascinating about sport, wasn't he, in live sport? And actually, one of my listeners, Tom McGauley in Drogheda, is saying, how are you surviving, Alistair, without going to Turf Moor to see your beloved Burnley football in action?
Well, that's a really interesting thing, because I did an interview a few weeks into the lockdown, and somebody said, what are you missing most about lockdown? And I said, straight away, football. Mm. And that was the answer. However, I went to a game recently. I do sometimes do the commentary for the Burnley website, and I went to a game at West Ham recently, West Ham Burnley, and we won, and we're playing really well, and, you know, we've had an amazing post-lockdown. We've lost one game. We've won every other game. We've drawn two. And it's just been incredible. But I didn't really enjoy it. And the reason is because there were no fans there. So actually, I've realised it's not football that I love, it's Burnley that I love. And even Burnley without the fans is not the same. Yesterday, I watched our game against Norwich. I didn't watch the Arsenal game. I won't watch the Man United-Chelsea game today. Whereas in a normal time, I'd watch all of these games. So, and the thing that was really interesting about Gary Lineker Jamie Carragher and Jeff Stelling, they're the three football people that I spoke to, and Maro Itoje, the rugby player, they all reacted to it opposite to how I thought they would. I thought Gary Lineker would sail through it because he's such a kind of level-headed sort of guy. And he admitted he was finding it pretty difficult. And he said, and if you see the interview, if you actually go into a website, you listen to the podcast, when you watch him, he's kind of, you know, Gary Lineker is normally so incredibly smooth and he's kind of relaxed and all that. He was kind of a bit twitchy and he kept touching his face and rubbing his arm. And, you know, I felt he was really struggling. And Jeff Stelling, Sky Sports, who, again, I would say that guy, you know, he can sail through anything. He admitted he was really, really, really struggling. And I actually said to him, I said, you know, Jeff, you sound depressed. And he said, well, look, you know what? I wake up in the morning and I've got no motivation to get out of bed. I do things like things that I would normally enjoy, like I'm going for a walk, I'm not enjoying it. And then Jamie Carragher, who I thought would, again, hate it because he is the most football-obsessed person I've ever met in my life, he said, you know what, I feel really guilty, but I'm quite enjoying it. I miss the football, but the rest of it, I'm loving it. Loving being with the kids, loving for going long walks, loving, you know. Mm. And so it was very interesting how people were not reacting as I thought they would. And the reaction was interesting because, I mean, look, all the people I spoke to were, you know, were well-known people. And I got quite a lot of people saying, you know, what about talking to, you know, quotes, ordinary people? I hate that phrase, but you know what I mean? Mm. And I'm doing that as well. But the reason why I found interesting to talk to those people was because they were reflecting that actually their fame and their wealth and all the rest of it didn't make any difference to them. The fact that Jeff Stelling's, you know, pretty well paid and living in a beautiful house with a nice family, it didn't make any difference to him. He was not enjoying it because he'd lost the rhythm of his life. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are getting that. And then, as you said in your introduction, add in the economic cost that's going to come and unemployment and all that, it's going to be horrific.
Do you think that mental health remains the last great taboo? I mean, look, listening to you, you've been really honest about your mental health down the years now. Lots of people in Ireland are very honest as well, especially well-known people. When they come out and admit that they have mental health issues, that seems to be very important, especially for younger people. But do you think it still remains a taboo, Alistair?
Yeah, it is. It's much, much better than it was. But I'll give you an example. Fiona and I, when we were back in London recently, we went out for a walk and I was feeling... I was sometimes when I'm very depressed, I literally can't speak. I find it impossible to speak. I'm sure there's lots of breathlessness in listening. I wish it was like that all the time. But we went to buy some fruit and to the fruit stall that we always go to, and we normally have a bit of a laugh and a bit of a chat and, you know, football and politics and whatever. And I just wasn't in the mood. And so I was just standing there holding the dog and I wasn't speaking. And Fiona said to the guy, the guy said to Fiona, what's wrong with him then? And she said, oh, he's got a really bad depression at the moment. And the guy said, what's he got to be depressed about? You've got a great life. And of course, that is still an attitude. People almost think that if you've got a decent living, if you've got a nice house, if you've got a nice family, if you've got nice holidays, if you can do the things you want to do with your life, then why would you get depression? And of course, it's not like that. It's not a lifestyle choice. It's an illness. And I also think that in the health, I met somebody a couple of years ago now in the health service, a nurse, who told me that she was bipolar. She'd never admitted it. She wouldn't dare admit it because she was convinced that if she admitted it to her employers, that would be the end of any promotion prospects for her. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what she thinks. So that's stigma and that's taboo. And I also, my big worry at the moment, let's say with your government, I heard an interview with your mental health minister recently. Is it Mary Butler?
Yeah.
Is that the right, I've got the right name? And I heard this interview and I thought, she gets it. She understands what's going on here. I mean, our mental health minister is Nadine Dorris, who most of your listeners probably only know from being on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Boris Johnson, I don't think gets it on any level. I'm not convinced that Matt Hancock, health minister, does. And I really, really, really worry that with all the other challenges coming out of COVID, health, economic, industrial, social, cultural, all the problems we've got, I've got a real worry that mental health is going to go back to the bottom of the queue again.
One thing, though, you do mention, apart from yourself, which I always think is important, about how many of the world's most successful people did have mental health issues. In other words, I know you spoke there about that nurse being worried about being honest with her employer, but like Abraham Lincoln, Churchill, Martin Luther King, I mean, lots of people did have serious mental health issues and yet were extremely successful in their own lives.
I know, and I find that one of the most extraordinary things. I mean, I once got described in a profile, somebody said that I'd had a good life despite a successful career, despite a history of mental illness. And I saw the guy, and I wasn't sort of aggressive about it, I just said, listen, the next time you write about me, just think about this. Maybe I've had a good life in part because of a history of mental illness. In other words, it's given me stuff that other people maybe don't get. I mean, I think having, you know, I've written 16 books now. Now, some of them, yes, the diaries are different, but the novels I've written, for example, every single one of them is about mental illness at root. And every single one of them has come to me when I've either been very, very depressed or very, very manic. Mm. And that's a plus to me. And likewise, I think that, you know, sometimes people say to me when, you know, less so now because I'm not as high profile as I was, but when Britain had a decent government that wasn't full of complete chances and liars and charlatans that we have now, I was under the cosh a lot of the time, and people would say, how do you cope with it? And I would say, and I think this is a truthful answer, I would say I can cope with it because I've coped with worse when I've been psychotic or when I've been depressed. Mm. And so that gives you something. And so I think I still, as you say, you mentioned Lincoln and Churchill and Luther King and, you know, Florence Nightingale and Marie Curie. Some of the greatest people in history were mentally ill. And yet we still, for politics, for example, it's still considered a really risky thing. Sadiq Khan did it recently. Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, He said that he'd really struggled like mentally in lockdown. And the other day he was up before the assembly members, and one of them was, you know, having a bit of a go at him. Do you think it was the right thing to say that you were struggling and that you weren't given the least significant to? And I actually thought it was a huge point in his favour that he said. And Nicola Sturgeon said the same. She didn't say she was depressed, but she said, you know, some days she found it
difficult,
harder than others, and she was finding the weight of dealing with all this death and these difficult challenges. She was finding it really, really hard at the emotional level.
My listeners say, I always love listening to Alistair. We need more mental health advocates. His honesty is refreshing. Another says, Miriam, love the man, love his honesty. My daughter is a nurse in London and she's finding COVID very difficult. That's Marion Kildare. I'll bring you one more. Catherine Kavanagh says, loving this. Alistair Campbell is so concise and accurate on the subject, and the insights into how it's affected sports people during lockdown are brilliant. Thanks, Public Service Broadcasting Masterclass. Before, I do want to mention your book, and you haven't asked me to do that, but your new book is coming out soon. But before that, for anyone listening this morning, Alistair, before I let you go, who's feeling down, whose mental health is not in a great place, say something to them.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's really hard because, you know, everybody's very, very different, and there'll be some people thinking... There's actually somebody in called Carmen who's in Ireland, who's I talk to quite a lot on social media, and I know she's struggling at the moment. And what I'd say to people is, first of all, you're not alone. Mm. Lots of people are feeling the same. Secondly, there'll be a good reason why you're feeling like that. I mean, lockdown is a pretty good... COVID, the worries of COVID, that's a pretty reasonable thing to be worried about. Mm. Nothing wrong with that. And then I'd say, if you're finding the big things difficult, do some little things. So, for example, when I'm feeling very, really low, and maybe I've got maybe I'm trying to finish a book, or I've got a meeting with somebody that's really, really important, or whatever, I'll think, right, before I do that, you know, sometimes for me, shaving is a turning point. If I'm depressed, I find it hard to shave, so I shave. Going for a walk, if I can't go for a run, go for a walk. If I can't write 1,000 words, write 200. In other words, give yourself little wins. And when you've done the little win, just say to yourself, right, I did that. If I can do that, maybe I can try the next thing. And I think the other thing I'd say is find in your life the right person to talk to. Often it's not your partner. It's not your parents. It's not your siblings. Often it is, by the way. And if it is, that's great. If it's in the family, that's fantastic. But sometimes families are difficult to be totally honest with about how you're feeling, because they might be the reason why you're feeling the way you are. Mm. So find the person, and we've all got that person. And the other thing I'd say finally is, if you really are worried, then there is no shame in picking up a phone and phoning the doctor and saying, "Can I come and see you?"
That's good. Now, your book, Living Better, it's you had to postpone all the launch for it and everything, but it's a really honest account of your lifelong struggle with depression, isn't it, Alistair? And when can they buy it if they want to?
Well, it's not out till September,
okay.
But you can pre-order I think you can pre-order on my website, alistaircampbell.org, and you can definitely pre-order on Amazon, which I know they don't pay tax, so maybe you don't want to do that. Although, you probably got them. Are they located in Ireland? And then the other thing is the publisher, John Murray's. I know you can get it there. But,
okay. You
know, it's out in September. I'm hoping that I will, well, I'm sure I will be in Ireland talking about it, not least because, as we've just heard from you reading out those messages, I love coming to Ireland because the people tend to be nicer there. And I promise you, the next time I do an interview with a British radio station, they'll say, "Well, some nice things here, Alistair, but yes, here's a few calling you a war criminal and blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah." So I always love talking to Irish radio.
And finally, actually, I haven't had any of those texts this morning, but Sheila in Galway finally says, "My daughter is bipolar and is straight up about it. It would be better if everybody was. Many thanks to Alistair for his honesty." I'll leave it at that, Alistair. Hopefully might see you when you come back to Ireland in September.
All right, Miriam.
Thanks so much. Mind
all
yourself.
Best.
Take care.
Bye.
Jenny Murray is one of the UK's most brilliant broadcasters. In her new book, Fat Cow, Fat Chance, the presenter of BBC Radio 4's Woman's Hour focuses on weight and how she's been battling with weight ever since she was a young girl. Over the next 5 decades, she tried every diet going from amphetamines to Atkins, and at her biggest was 24 stone, but it wasn't until she paid for a gastric band that she began to lose a significant amount of weight. And yet the stigma of weight and eating plagues so many of us. In her book, she writes all about the science and psychology of size and tries to understand how a super intelligent and well-educated woman such as herself was powerless with it when it came to her weight. And I'm joined now by Dame Jenny Murray. Morning, Jenny.
Good morning, Miriam.
Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Listen, it's a fascinating book. Tell me, first of all, about your childhood and your mom, because she plays a significant role in all of this, doesn't she, Jenny?
Well, you know, you have to be forgiving of mothers who may have caused you problems. You have to remember that my mother grew up during the war. She was a teenager during the Second World War. During a time of terrible rationing where you couldn't get so many things. You couldn't get sugar, you couldn't get butter, you couldn't make all the lovely puddings that it was traditional in those kind of working class Yorkshire families to make. And then in 1950, she had me, and rationing was easing. And suddenly, oh my goodness, they could get the meat that they wanted, they could get butter, they could get sugar, they could start to cook all the things that they had missed during the wartime diet, which actually was probably, from a health point of view, a very good diet. But here they were, my mother and my grandmother, with this little girl who was quite a big girl. I was, you know, just over 9 pounds when I was born. So I inherited my father's bone structure rather than my mother's lovely slender bone structure. But for them, they had both been educated, but not to university level. My mother should have been, but when she left school at 16, she got a job with the civil service. And then when she got married and had a child, she had to leave, just as my grandmother had to leave her job when she was married and had a child. So they were devoted to looking after the house and looking after the food. And my mother would cook the most delicious things. My grandmother's Yorkshire pudding was to die for. And they would fill the plate, lovely big portions. "There you are, love, you know, eat everything up." And I'd get halfway through it and say, "But Mum, I'm full, I don't want any more." "Oh, come on, you know, I've spent all morning making this for you, and you will eat it, all of it." And that introduces terribly bad habits. You know, I say to parents of children, if your children say they're full, don't force them to eat anymore. Because my mum would say, if you can't eat it now, it'll be there tonight and you'll eat it cold. Because she couldn't bear the thought of wasting food, and she couldn't bear the thought that what she was trying to express her love through was being rejected by me. So I didn't get fat when I was a child. I first really got fat at university, which is not unusual. Hmm. The first few terms at university where, first of all, you're drinking alcohol for the first time because everybody goes off to the reunion and has a pint. You tend to go to the canteen and you eat a lot of rubbish with chips. And then when you're back in your student accommodation, you're eating toast. And I put on, I was 9.5 stone when I went to university. When my mother saw me for the first time after my first couple of terms, I weighed 11.5 stone. And she was horrified. I mean, she said, oh, my God, what's happened to you? You look like a baby elephant. And that's when I went to the doctor at the University Medical Center and said, look, I really need to lose weight. My mother thinks I look like a baby elephant. What can I do to lose it? And he said, oh, I'll give you some pills and it will help. Hence the amphetamines. I lost so much weight. I went down to 7 stone. I read in a magazine that a really good diet to lose weight was to eat nothing but boiled eggs and tomatoes. To this day, I could not eat a boiled egg and a tomato on the same plate. You know, I can eat them separately, but not on the same plate. I went down to 7 stones. And my tutor said, Jenny, something is going drastically wrong here. You know, your work's not as good as it was. You're very emotional. What are you taking? And I said, I'm not taking any drugs. I don't do drugs. And he said, no, but you must be taking something. I said, well, only the pills the doctor gave me. He said, show me. So I showed him the pills and he said, oh, Lord, those are black bombers. I'd never even heard the term black bombers. They were very powerful amphetamines and clearly did me no good at all in the long term. And then, you know, I got back to a steady weight. I got into my 30s. I had a couple of children. And it was in my 40s that it started to get really, really difficult because woman's hour moved to the morning rather than the afternoon. So I was getting up very early in the morning, 5 o'clock. To get to work on time. So I was eating more probably as the day progressed than I normally would. I used to have a couple of nice lattes and a couple of croissants in the morning and then, you know, on the day would go. But I was also on my own for a large part of the week in a little flat in Camden Town in London, which I called Wuthering Depths, by the way. And my family, we'd moved up to the Peak District so that the boys could go to school at Manchester Grammar School. So they were there during the week. I was in London during the week and I was getting increasingly depressed and didn't care about the kind of food I was eating. I'd go out and buy pizzas or, you know, get a takeaway, buy something that was really easy to put in the microwave. I was comfort eating and I became fatter and fatter. So I would do every diet known to man or woman. I did Atkins, I did Ducan, I did 5-2, I did the cabbage soup, and I would lose weight. And then just at the point where you think, oh, I'm cracking this, you know, that I've lost a lot of weight, you would become unaccountably hungry and go back to eating again, and you would put on even more weight than you'd had when you started the diet. So when I began to think about writing the book, I needed to find out what's the science behind this. Why do so many of us go on a diet, lose a lot of weight, and 95% of us will put back the weight within, on the whole, 2 years? And I now realise, because I met Professor Francesca Rubino, who was the surgeon who did, I didn't have a gastric band. I had a sleeve, a gastric sleeve, where 80% of your stomach is actually removed, which sounds a bit drastic, but it's really not. And he started to explain to me the science of what had been happening to my body, because our weight gain and weight loss is very much dependent on genetics and on metabolism and hormones. And what he taught me is that at the point at which I'd lost all that weight, my body would say that there's a hormone called leptin that would go rushing up to my brain and say, oh my goodness, she's starving, she's losing far too much weight, make her eat, make her eat. And you become really hungry and you put all the weight back on. You know, people often say it's as simple as eat less and exercise more. I'm afraid it's not. I also obviously have a gene that makes me tend to get fat. I had two very fat grandmothers. When we look at the genetics of it and you look back and back and back into your ancestry, and you find that at some point somewhere you had people who were living in an area where there was very little food. You know, it might have been the Irish potato famine. Not in my case. I don't have an Irish ancestry. I have a Welsh ancestry. But the people who were able to benefit from what little food there was and managed to retain fat, they were the people who survived.
Well, you know, Jenny, it's incredibly moving. It's a brutally honest memoir. Everyone should read it. Honestly, I thought it was fascinating. Fat Cow, Fat Chance, The Science Psychology of Size by you, Jenny Murray. You're a brilliant broadcaster. We never miss Women's Hour. It's published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for chatting to me this morning. I was really, really pleased to talk to you.